Hello there, and a very good morning to you. August Banathine Fale Padrig Orv Gulair. A lovely day out there. I hope it's lovely all around the country. Perfect marching day. Now we'll start with our headlines, the Sunday Times. The toddler saved by his daddy. That's a lovely story of a man saving his son's life during that terrible event in New Zealand. And he just threw himself over the son and took the bullets, so to speak. The main story, back my Brexit or UK will never leave, says May. Guard the body settles tax penalties and Delaney's unexplained 100,000 cheque to the FAI. Now, the Sunday Independent, pensions injustice, as 86,000 may wait till they die. That's in inverted commas. And this is an anomaly, as they call it, that arose. It affects not exclusively, but mainly older women who had their payments reduced. Many would have thought very unjustly during the crash. Now, the Sunday Business Post, Anglo cut and pasted loan documents, the Quinns claim, and just reading up on that, it looks like the court case could go on, they say, for about 6 months, and there'll be lots of reading and eating and drinking in that, I would have thought. But it'll be sub judice, I guess, for 6 months. Now, the Irish Mail, Varadkar's McGregor PR disaster. I don't know what they're on about. You know, if you're in the one city, I'm in the same city as somebody else. Is that a disaster? Anyway, Varadkar's McGregor PR disaster, says the Irish Mail on Sunday. The Sunday World has a Nicola Tallant exclusive on drugs and cab and all of that world. The Irish Sun has a proper shambles. This is referring to Leo and Connor, and Connor rains on Leo's parade. It's in the gas. If you look, it's the ones that chose to use that as their main story. Anyway, across the water, the Observer revealed EU wargaming for fall of May government, and the Sunday Telegraph, May begs patriotic MPs to back the deal. Well, I thought patriotism had gone out the window over there pro-Tem, as everybody seems to be fighting for their own party and their own space. Well, with me in studio, Donal Donovan, former Deputy Director of the IMF, Bobby McDonough, former Irish Ambassador to UK, EU and Italy, Alison Morris, Security Correspondent and Columnist with the Irish News, Niamh Lyons, Political Editor at Times Ireland, and Declan Power, Security Analyst, and you are all most welcome indeed. Well, seeing the day that's in it and St. Patrick's Day and all of that, there were a couple of stories. There was one written by Archbishop Eamon Martin, but there was another story about there are going to be less masses. Niamh, did you have a look at that?
I had a look at it. I was just thinking in my head, when I read it, I was thinking, I wouldn't have even have thought of going to Mass today. My mother will kill me for saying that. But it's just not on my radar that, and it's ridiculous to say because, of course, it's St. Patrick's Day, but the thing sort of in my psyche around St. Patrick's Day is the fun element of it. But the talk...
Lowering standards, dreadful.
The talk of, you know, bishops being gobsmacked about, you know, parishioners getting, you know, are in the sort of older age demographic, and I suppose certain priests retiring and no priests to replace them in certain parts of the country. You know, this is all happening at the same time as they can't build mosques big enough.
Yep.
Across the Middle East. You know, people are hammering down doors to pray in other parts of the world. So I think the Irish Catholic Church in particular probably just needs to take a good look at itself and realise what it is about the message that's not hitting home to people. Because my parents often give out to me when I say things about, you know, reparation for child sex abuse and all the scandals and whatever, because they say, look, we are the church. That's not us. the priest down in Malahide where my parents, my father's minister for the word, my mother's minister for the Eucharist, that's nothing to do with us. But at the same time, there's a broader feeling that the social jump that we've taken politically has not been reflected in the Irish Catholic Church. And with that, we also sort of continue to have the scandals cropping back up. And I did feel when the Pope recently brought the bishops and the cardinals I looked at it and I kind of thought, you know, there was one particular cardinal, I think he was from the Philippines, who was weeping as he spoke about the wrongs of the church. I thought to myself, that really jarred with me, the idea that they only seem now to be coming around to the idea.
Right, well, there was an awful lot of covering up going on. Donald, did you have a look at that?
Yes, I did, actually. You know, what Anne said is there's a lot to it, but I think it's maybe time, and I think you wouldn't disagree, you know, to go beyond the point of saying, well, the church is not getting supported because of all the sex scandals over decades and decades and decades. That's all true and very bad. But I think the more fundamental point is why most Irish people, well over 50%, are not regular, you know, supporters and attendees and participants in the church. And it's not, I think, only or largely to do with the history of sex abuse. It has to do, I think, to be honest, with more mundane things, but important things like materialism, liberal social values, unrestricted, you know, desire for unrestricted.
Capitalism, I think he mentioned that as well.
You know, and that just doesn't do well with a more austere, if you like, spiritual life. And that's really what we're seeing. And we're not just seeing it in Ireland, but in Spain, France, and even
Italy,
to some extent Germany.
Yeah.
But if you
Bobby?
Think of if you think of the reason that why the church decided to come out against the two recent referenda that we had. You know, it's an interesting thing that, say, if you take the marriage equality, gay people didn't want to get married in the Irish Catholic Church. They just wanted the right to marry. Now, there was probably nothing stopping the church's Catholic teachings in just taking a more, you know, Christian view of people wanting to get married. Not necessarily changing their doctrine on that.
Right. Bobby?
Marianne, I would have been at Mass today if I hadn't come on your show, so you're responsible for my immortal soul.
It's an occasion of sin, Bobby.
You could have got up earlier, Bobby.
Well, there are limits. I'm with Alison's parents on this, that the church is us, it's not those people out there. And it is perfectly possible to be a practicing, committed Catholic and to vote in favour of the marriage equality referendum, which I did and very many people did. I think
that baffled people. You know, that you would accept all the teaching and then vote in the manner that you did. I don't think they got that in the Vatican.
Well, it depends on what the essence of Christianity is. Mm. I mean, there's not much point being a Christian if you don't believe that Jesus was God. Or you don't believe the basic messages of the gospel.
Right.
But you don't have to believe in the formal institutional church and everything that they say. They've got a lot of things wrong, including homosexuality. And I must say, you know, the recent synod in Rome, where the television shots just show hundreds and hundreds of male cardinals and bishops lined up.
It's not, look at all those women.
It's not serious.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make me in any way turn away from the church, because the church doesn't belong to them, it belongs to us.
Okay.
And one other point, if I could, about Islam and the point that was made that a lot of Muslims still are practicing. I had a wonderful teacher at school, a priest, who later in life said to me that he thought that Europe would be re-evangelized by Islam. And I think what he meant was that when we got an opportunity to see people who are not embarrassed about their faith and regained a confidence in it, maybe Islam could have a positive effect on
us. The funny thing, when you talk about they can't build the mosques fast enough in the bits of Africa that I'm aware of, they can't build Pentecostalist churches fast enough either. How is it going north of the border, Alison?
I think, just to pick up the point that struck me, it's that very male, you know, dominated church, and it hasn't modernised. It doesn't reflect modern society. And we even seen when the Pope's visit, as you said, you lined up these grey-haired men, and then you expect young people then to feel some affinity to something that looks so alien to them and so of, you know, of another world. And I think it's more than just about having less masses and trying to modernise socially. I think that they really need to reflect on probably the vow of celibacy, about women priests, all sorts of things that would make the church look more like the world that we now live in.
Right. Last word to you on this, Declan.
Well, I think all
organized religions are in a state of evolution. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, people were predicting an end to it, but it fills, you know, I think there is a gap, people feel a gap, you know, if there's no, a void, if they don't have some sort of spiritual life, let's put it that way, in whatever shape or form that may take. I think Islam, from what I can see, in Europe, in the West, is going through a bit of an evolution. We see clerics like Umar al-Qadri preaching a kind of a Western-centric a set of Islamic values that's
very
compatible.
Tolerant.
So I think
and
that,
respectful.
That's, and indeed, and then within the Catholic context, which is what you raised here, you know, I take on board Alison's comments. The upper echelon of the church is very different to what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis, because women have such a prominent role in the day-to-day operations of the church. They couldn't survive without them, from women like Josepha Madigan, who's made her opinions known, and she puts her money where her mouth is, to people like my own mother, like Niamh's parents. She's a minister of the word, and my father was a minister of the Eucharist. And I think we can all relate to that. So on the ground, I think the church is gradually changing, shifting. I mean, even in terms of the referendums that took place, I knew of people that would have considered themselves very devout, and clerics as well, who were saying, well, look, Mike, you know, your conscience, we're getting a sort of a Protestant consciousness of conscience, which I think is a healthy thing. Yeah. We're becoming less pedestrian, those who want to practice the Catholic version of Christianity. Yeah. We're becoming less pedestrian and more making decisions for ourselves. I always remember Conor Brady, the former editor of the Irish Times, point. Yeah, he was raised a Catholic, but he said, first and foremost, he considers himself a Christian, and the particular brand of it happens to be Catholicism.
Yep, there you
and
go.
I kind of fall into that line myself, and I think an awful lot of people our generation do.
Okay, well, we will leave that there and move along. I'm sorry we kept you from Mass this morning, but maybe there'll be an evening one that you can keep an eye out for. Now, not surprisingly, we have, I was going to say Margaret Thatcher, Theresa May begging people and writing in the Telegraph today on her Brexit, we should give the UK time to escape the mess. That's part of Colin McCarthy's article today. Sindo, risk of no deal Brexit not going away. That's Dan O'Brien. Endless coverage of it. Bobby, since you have lived in that world of diplomacy and how you get a deal across the line and keeping everybody together and keeping the 27 stuck together, I presume, because I suspect people are getting a little browned off now with Theresa May, though I think a lot of people have grown respect for her.
Well, I think there was a certain amount of respect for her, and maybe still is some, but I think it's wearing a little thinner. She was trying to get through a deal which she negotiated and got a number of compromises on, and she's still trying to get that through. But certainly I was very concerned when she started saying that to have a second referendum would undermine the British people's faith in democracy. It's perfectly legitimate to try and get her deal through, but to try and close off other options seems to me to be very risky. Mm. I think the EU has held together and will hold together. Sometimes it's presented in the British media as, you know, the EU have differences going into this next European Council. But yeah, of course they have differences. They're 27 independent democratic countries. But what they do is they will come together and respond to whatever form of request comes from Theresa May for an extension. And they will do so intelligently and calmly and generously. But they don't have an answer at the moment in a drawer, because she hasn't said what she wants, and they don't yet have a common position, but they will have one.
You were in the UK, that was one of your posts, so you probably know the whole scene better than most. What does your gut tell you? Some of the articles this morning were saying that Jacob Rees-Mogg might shift. And you think, my goodness, that would be the end of religion as we know it. Do you think they would? Would they care about losing face? Do they care about... We get the impression that she cares more about not dividing her party than the country. But you'd have a better suss on that.
Well, so far, the indications are that she has put party before country. She hasn't used the opportunity, the obvious opportunity, to reach out across to the natural majority in the House of Commons, which favours a softer Brexit. It seems to me, in summary, that the shenanigans of the last couple of weeks have made no deal less likely, but not impossible. And they haven't helped the case for a second referendum
could
either.
Could it not happen accidentally?
It could happen accidentally. That's where the risk lies. But I think the two possibilities that have become more centre stage, shall we say, are her own deal, there is growing pressure on the Jacob Rees-Mogg's and the DUP to shift their position, because the more obvious alternative to that now seems to be a long extension and maybe Brexit being frittered away.
Yeah.
The other possibility, the central possibility, is to go for a softer Brexit, which is probably what she should have done after the last general election, but so far she's shown no signs of doing.
Right.
It is possible to laugh at what's happening in the House of Commons. I mean, well, I have friends who said they would rather watch the House of Commons than the Champions League last week. But we shouldn't forget that there are a lot of extremely decent MPs in the House of Commons who are trying to...
And it's a serious matter.
A very serious matter. Mm. And many Labour MPs, for example, are trying to bring their party leader on board for a more moderate Brexit. And there are very courageous Tory MPs, not to mention the Lib Dems, the Greens and so on. So they will all be working to try and... To try and get something through here. But the first question, this is not just because the first question will be Theresa May's attempt to get her deal through on the third time of asking, and we simply don't know what the outcome of that is.
Did you hear that just in the headlines before we came on air, the suggestion that she mightn't ask it now, mm-hmm. unless if she doesn't have the numbers?
Yes, I think it would look extremely bad from her point of view not to put the issue on the table. But on the other hand, to put it again... and lose again would be very bad. So we don't know yet. I mean, I can't see quite what the point would be to put it again on the table and lose. But the options are narrowing for the extreme Brexiteers. And her hope is that a number of them will indicate their willingness to come on board.
And I think the problem is she doesn't need to convince the ERG. She needs to convince the DUP because the ERG are not going to out-unionist the unionists. If the DUP say we'll go with it, they will fall in behind them. And they've already said they will do that. And in Northern Ireland, everyone, we voted to remain, but yet the only representation we have at Westminster are the DUP or hard Brexiteers. Sinn Féin don't take their seats, so there's no other voices being heard apart from Lady Sylvia Herman.
Who stands out, really, doesn't she? Yeah.
And is a lady in every sense of the word, you know, a wonderful woman and a wonderful advocate for her constituency. But she's such a small voice among, you know, in the power that the DUP have. They've exploited it, they've abused it. And I think that...
Well, have they abused it?
Well, they have abused it in terms of what people in Northern Ireland want. And even the business community and the farming community have told the DUP that they prefer the withdrawal agreement.
I'm aware of that. But she sticks to her philosophy, which is that she's British and Northern Ireland is British. They're part of the UK. And she's hanging on to that because she believes in it.
And it is. And it's an ideology and it's what their supporters want. But at the same time, if they get what we think is happening, if they wind down the clock till there's a hard Brexit, because that's all it takes. It just takes you to delay these votes and frustrate the votes and wind it down, and eventually we will have to drop out. If that happens and it's catastrophic for Northern Ireland, the DUP will have to answer to their voters. But in some ways, and what also we have been told is in the event of a hard Brexit, we were given a sort of contingency plan of what would happen, which would keep Northern Ireland would be completely different from the rest of the UK. So they need to be careful what they're wishing for in that respect.
Donal, you want to go in?
Yeah, we of course don't know whether she'll get a deal through or not. But if it looks like she isn't, or she doesn't, at the end of the day, then to my mind, I think she should take the courageous step, along with what the options Bobby was suggesting, and break with the red line of no customs union. She will have a natural majority, a high majority in the House of Commons. Corbyn will have to support her.
Well, he's already called for that.
He's already called for that. Now, the single market is a separate issue, but that can be handled a bit later on, and it's more a itty-bitty thing, sector by sector. She'll have a natural majority in the House of Commons. Of course, the hard Brexiteers will go crazy because they live in the fantasy world of outside the customs union, we'll have wonderful deals with China, Brazil and God
knows who. Well, does that mean they couldn't do deals with...
That's right, absolutely. That's the key point of a customs union. You get all the benefits from being able to trade within the EU and Britain, between EU and Britain, without any tariffs or no problems with Ireland or whatever. But you cannot have separate trade deals. But in my view, and I've always believed this, that the separate trade deals are fantasies with, you know, Trump and China and all these things. And they're
Mr.
not necessary.
Trump think he could do the business with them.
But the point is that I would say that, of course, this involves her swallowing her pride and going back. But she doesn't have an awful lot of pride left. And I actually believe that if she goes with that route, she would actually emerge quite well, because she would be seen as putting, you know, country before party, statesman-like, stateswoman-like, whatever. And, you know, people would say, good on you. The other thing I would say is that the people of Britain, when they voted yes for the referendum, they did not vote to leave the customs union. They actually didn't.
We don't know that, though,
well,
do we?
There was no discussion for customs union.
No, but I heard Boris Johnson going on about trade deals and we'll trade the world.
Marion, I am absolutely sure that most people in Britain didn't even know what a customs union was, as opposed to a free trade deal or a single market. In fact, many of them I still think are not clear about it. But no, what they voted for was two things, I think. One was control over immigration, and second, removing the yoke of Brussels, you know, the Brussels bureaucrats.
And the court, exactly.
Now, they would get all of that by staying in the customs union. They would certainly still have control over immigration, because that's nothing to do with the customs union. They would have some controls, or not really controls, some regulations from Brussels, because if they want to trade between Britain and the UK, you know, export something to the EU, you have to
have standards.
You have to have standards. But as I say, you know, if the Brits want to make the ice cream in England for their own consumption, just for themselves, and they're not planning to export it anywhere, Brussels has no say on that whatsoever.
Right.
It's only if you're in the single market that Brussels tells you the shape of your bananas and so
on. Which I understand they never did.
They never really did. You know, it's exaggerated. But the last thing I would say is that actually, no matter what will happen over the next while, in my view, this is a prediction, whatever the outcome is, in about 3 years, Britain would be in the customs union anyway, after the renegotiation of the arrangements, because it's so obviously economically good for all parties. And it also, by the way, finally, it does remove to a large extent all of this problem about the backstop. Not completely, but most of it. So, long extension, she says she wants a trade, stays in the customs union, we're off.
Okay, Niamh?
Yeah, I think it's ironic in many ways, and there's a lot of ironies about Brexit, but one of them being that the reason David Cameron felt he needed to put the question was to save the Conservative Party, because this sense from within that they were going to smash themselves apart on the European question, and that UKIP were really building up the pressure from the outside. Now, we've seen with successive elections that UKIP have now managed to vote themselves out of existence with Brexit. The only place they're actually managing to get seats is in the European Parliament. So that's one issue. Like, the fact that she's pandering to that one particular group. George Parker described in the Financial Times this week that she's losing her way to victory. So ironic. But I think in terms of extension and the vote, you know, the short-term extension is only just enough time for them to get their own legislation through. So they need until April 25th. So unprepared are they for their own Brexit. Like, we will have our emergency legislation through. It's going through the rocks like a bullet. I've never seen anything move so quickly, and that's obviously because of the cooperation of all parties and none. But they haven't got their ducks in a row in that regard yet. Our own government, I think it appears, seems to favour, certainly Pascal Donoghue, on a St. Patrick's Day trip to London, seemed to suggest that a longer period might be necessary. But what appears to be coming as a real shock to people in Britain is that they would have to vote in the European elections.
Yeah.
I just think that would be bizarre.
It would cause
bizarre.
Such divisions.
I think it would almost come nearly
society.
As another referendum somehow be seen as people, you know, there would be some very staunch anti-EU Eurosceptic hardliners, and then there would be the Remainers telling people, probably incorrectly, that there could be a second referendum. So I don't actually think she is, at the moment, I wouldn't get the impression she's going to delay that vote. She has said that before previous votes. Interestingly, David Davis is writing in the Sunday Times today, and he voted, he's saying himself, against his own better judgment for the last agreement. He's saying now that this is resolvable by giving Northern Ireland a legislative guarantee that it will never be separated from the rest of the UK. Now, maybe he hasn't read the Good Friday Agreement or doesn't know it exists. But that type of language, and people give out to us for talking about unity and border polls, and that's the type of language we're hearing from the guy who began the Brexit negotiations. He's also saying, by the way, that he thinks there needs to be 22 different sectoral teams that now negotiate, take over from the civil servants, in the trade deal talks, because he feels that the civil servants actually aren't up to the job, that they're kind of learning themselves into the role as they go along, and they're possibly getting bogged down in the sort of administrative end when really they should be sort of more sharply looking at the deal.
Hasn't he some kind of nerve to say that, in the sense that presumably it's quite the opposite, is that the politicians haven't been able... Now, I don't know anything about British civil servants, but I mean...
If it wasn't for the permanent government, there probably wouldn't be much government at the moment.
Right. Yeah. It's particularly rich that somebody who made a mess of the negotiations himself should say that the civil service couldn't cope. Yeah. I mean, the role of civil servants is to tell politicians the truth and the options. And part of the unreality of British politics now is that the politicians just don't want to hear the truth and the reality.
Right. You picked out Dan O'Brien's article, Declan.
I did, yeah. I've been following Dan's writings on Brexit over the last while. It's just, I think Dan, from the perspective of being a hard-nosed economist, but also Owen Harris as well, who we don't often get to hear too much from, they both remind us of the dangers of maybe xenophobia and groupthink. And that's on a broader basis, while taking these point there have been some catastrophic statements that have emanated from Westminster that show a lack of historical grasp and detail. But we don't have to follow that line of thinking either. And groupthink and restoring old sentimental anti-English approaches won't help us either. We have to be objective. When the dust settles after this, however
they're
way
still
it works
our
out,
next door neighbour.
We still have to have a close relationship for all kinds of sensible and practical reasons. Now, Dan makes one particular point that has been addressed by a lot of the panel here. We're not home and dry because of the vote in Westminster about a no deal, not crashing out. And we need to keep in mind that, okay, we're getting closer to the line and it's looking like there's a bit of giving and taking. But, many a slip twixt cup and lip. And also, I often ask this question, what are our fallback contingencies if things go in different ways? And what would we be prepared to concede? I know in a previous article, Dan O'Brien was saying, if we adhere to the backstop to the point that if the house is burnt down, we're trying to save the house, but will it be burnt down? I'm always in favour of alternative competing hypothesis. Right. Like if we did put a date of 10 years on it, would that not be enough for things to be negotiated? And would it give more sensible elements? Geoffrey Donaldson seeming to be the only one with a kind of a more reasoned element. Would it give them something to get off the hooks that they've put them on?
I think it was very concerning that Geoffrey Cook said that you could override an international treaty if it was causing instability. Because all that says to me is there's hardline elements within unionism as well as within nationalism, who if the backstop did kick in and they wanted out of it, what do they have to do? They just have to make the place unstable, and then that would then override it and we could go back. And I think that was very dangerous language. What I have noticed is that there is such a lack of understanding about Northern Ireland and our complexities in Westminster. They just do not get it.
Yeah.
I mean, even Jacob Rees-Mogg, who must be, closely aligned to the DUP, when he was being interviewed in relation to the border, they asked, have you been to the border? And he said, no, but I've spoken to the Irish MPs about it. I assume he meant the DUP, and even him as their closest ally doesn't get, that sort of sense of Britishness and Irishness.
Right.
And Brexit has just divided Northern Ireland so much, it is so frustrating to watch because we came so far. And now all of a sudden, it's causing it is.
Could I make a point about the end date on
briefly,
the backstop?
Very
briefly, sorry. Because I think the point to start with is, what is the backstop? So the backstop is a way of ensuring that the balances of the Good Friday Agreement are preserved, that the Irish dimension is given the full weight that it deserves. So I would be very reluctant, indeed opposed to putting an end date, because I don't think you can put an end date to the balances of the Good Friday Agreement. And I think the European Union as a whole has been flexible. It's adapted the nature of the backstop to suit Theresa May's wishes. But I think an end date would undermine its very nature.
OK, we'll leave it there for the moment, and I'm going to take a break. But before I do, can I just go to some of our callers? I've just been at 10 o'clock Mass in St. Luke's in Coolock, Dublin, and it was absolutely packed, says Mark. And another one saying, people are the church. And another one, I'm not a fan of the Catholic Church, but I don't hate it or the local priest. Any commentary about its message being outdated is utterly pointless. If you don't like it, don't take part. Why are people trying to change the church to suit their own quirks and beliefs? It is what it is. And despite not being a fan, I wouldn't expect change for me or anyone else, says James.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
welcome back to the programme. With us in studio this morning, Declan Power, Niamh Lyons, Alison Morris, Bobby McDonough and Donal Donovan. And we're going to move on to a different topic now. But just before a call came in to say, come the month of May, there'll hardly be an EU to leave. Look at developments in Italy, Spain, Hungary and France, and certainly you get the distinct impression that there is a lot of fracturing going on. Anyway, we are going to move on to another story, which is to do with Bloody Sunday. And we were talking yesterday at length to Tony Doherty about his father and the death of his father. Alison, you're a security correspondent and columnist, but it also touches you personally. What did you think? Let me talk about how it. Your cousin was killed.
Well, he wasn't killed on Bloody Sunday. He was killed by a soldier, and the soldier who killed him was actually, it was historic in that he was the first serving member of the British Army to be convicted of murder while on duty in Northern Ireland. My cousin Thomas Riley was shot in the back, and the soldier was convicted. He was sentenced to life in prison, and about 2 years into his sentence, my Aunt Brady was contacted by a documentary film crew maker who had been and asked the MOD could they interview the soldier in question in prison, and found out he wasn't in prison. He had been taken out of prison and put back into the army again, and that was how she found out. So in reality...
And tell me about him.
Oh, Thomas was really...
Because he was living the dream, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. He was a roadie for Spandau Ballet, and he'd been on tour with him. His funeral, you know, West Belfast came to a standstill. Bananarama and all sorts of 80s pop stars showed up to go to his funeral. And Paul Weller sent a wreath. And later, Spandau Ballet said that the bass through the barricades had been inspired, you know, by Thomas and Thomas's death. He was a lovely guy, and he was living. You know, he was only home for a few days to visit his mum when he was murdered. And I think that the repercussions of that, my aunt handled that with great dignity and very quiet dignity. And then last week when Karen Bradley stood up in the Commons and said that, you know, none of those crimes were murder, when I thought that was just so insulting to those families. So in reality, what we have is there's only three soldiers who have ever been convicted while on duty in Northern Ireland, and all three of them were put back into the army after serving a few years in prison. So we talk about an amnesty for soldiers. There's an unofficial amnesty for soldiers, and there always has been anyway. The Bloody Sunday stuff, I spent most of the last 2 weeks going back over Savile and speaking to solicitors and speaking to experts. And in my head, I thought maybe three soldiers would be charged, two in connection with murders and one with some of the injuries. So I can see why the families and everyone else was shocked that in the end it was only the
one. Were their expectations raised too much? And yeah. I saw the media being blamed for raising expectations.
I think that we all have a responsibility not to raise expectations. And the day of the Savile report was such a euphoric day for those families. And David Cameron made a statement. And when you look back at that such a day, you know, it was a day for them that I think that they thought they were going to replicate last week. And in reality, it was anything but that. And it was such a disappointment. And I think that everyone has a responsibility, first of all, to be realistic about these things. I mean, the headline in the Sunday Business Post says murder, perjury, lies and finally some justice. We are a long way off justice. I would be shocked if this ever even makes it to trial, because there's going to be so many judicial challenges. The soldier's going to want to keep his anonymity. That's going to be a High Court case. He's, I'm assuming, going to ask for it to be trialled in London rather than in Belfast. That would be a case. Is he going to have a jury? Is it going to be diplock? All these things will be subject to legal challenge, and that could go on for 2 or 3 years, at which point in time you have a 50-year-old crime and you're trying to trial it in a modern situation.
The other point you make is that, I mean, the families have come in for incredible respect in the way that they've handled all of this. And, I mean, the word dignity just comes out every single time. But within that, you figure that the families, one might want a court case, one might say, look, I want to get on with life and let's leave it. And so it's not that simple.
It's the same with all legacy cases. And I've been a journalist for 20 years, I've interviewed so many victims, and you'll never find two who want the same thing. So you might have a whole family with 5 or 6 siblings. One says, no, we want prosecutions, we want this to go to court. One will say, I just want an apology. Could someone just say sorry? Could someone just acknowledge our hurt? Some might want to take a civil case and go for compensation as acknowledgement of guilt, and some do just want to be left alone to get on with it. I mean, I've interviewed people who were married very young. Their husband was killed in their 20s. They've remarried, and in some cases their own children don't even know that their previous husband was murdered, and they just want to be left alone to get on with it. So there is no one group think. The Bloody Sunday families are very united in their support of each other, but they don't all want the same thing.
That makes it all the more complex, doesn't it? And all the more difficult, and all the more difficult emotionally for the families.
And I'm not even convinced that the British government, I think, have handled legacy so badly. They thought, much like Brexit, let's run down the clock and eventually these people will all die and go away and they'll stop asking questions. And that hasn't happened. And it's exaggerated. And I think that if they were genuine about getting justice and solving unsolved murders, we would be investigating these murders from 98 backwards, where the evidence actually exists and people are young enough to remember and eyewitnesses. We wouldn't be investigating them from the 70s forward.
The funny thing about it is your cousin, his granddad, fought for the British Army.
Both did, his grandfather and his grandfather. So my granddad, who Thomas was named after, he was a World War II war hero. He's a Japanese prisoner of war camp. My granny was told he was dead, and then the Americans found him in 1945 in a prisoner of war camp, and he came back, and he was a lovely, very quiet man. His father died in the First World War. He was a British soldier and he was called Thomas too. So these two men who were British soldiers, and Thomas was named after them, a British soldier shot him in the back, you know, and I think it shows the complicated nature of our history.
It certainly does. And just again referring back to the Doherty family, they also had a granddad that fought in World War One for the British Army. Like, it is very, very, very strange.
Just a point on that, Marion. It's not that they fought in whatever war for the British Army. I mean, probably the majority of people who served in the armed forces in both World Wars, particularly the Second World War, were from the nationalist community for a variety of reasons. A lot of them were professional soldiers, and a lot of them had an awareness because of the Spanish Civil War and the politics of the time of the dangers of Nazism. And, it's a travesty. You know, it shows you the problems here when you kind of start trying to divide people into tribal groups. Because of that, one of the winners of the Victoria Cross was a leading seaman, McGuinness. I'm trying to think of his first name. Eamon McGuinness, I think. He was from the Falls Road. And a statue couldn't be put up to him until the 1990s because he was an embarrassment to both communities. It reminded the nationalists of how many nationalists had fought in British uniform. It reminded the unionists, perhaps, the fact that there were no unionists who won a VC. And, you know, that history is so complex, and the sense of victimhood is intertwined into it, which kind of, coming back onto the whole Bloody Sunday thing, as I was listening to Alison talking about the sense of justice, there are so many people that have been denied a sense of justice, and we shouldn't forget them. The people who had to see the killers of family members get out due to the Good Friday Agreement, that was a huge ask of people across the political divide, that, you know, you're the killer of your husband or your father has only maybe done a few months or a year, a bit like those British soldiers who got out early. It shouldn't, in many respects, these things shouldn't happen. But in other respects, it asks us on a broader basis, there may at some point a line has to be drawn, and we say, well, that conflict is over and we will not revisit it from a judicial point of view.
Yeah, I thought David Cameron might have lanced the boil, you know, and that might have... I know that people were very pleased with what he said, and they were pleased with the report. But I presume there's a sense of injustice. It just won't.
Well, the Good Friday Agreement, there's been such complacency from Irish and British governments for the past 20 years on that legacy question. I mean, Justine McCarthy has a really good piece.
She has a very interesting thought.
I mean, if people were wrapping themselves in the flag for St. Paddy's Day, they should read this, because this really is her discussion about the route to a border poll, and it takes a look at it from an economic perspective. She has a very interesting line saying, when it comes to Ireland, Britain's political class never learns from its errors. Just as executions of the Easter Rising leaders led to independence, and as Bloody Sunday proved a recruitment magnet for the IRA, the despicable utterances emanating from Westminster are accelerating the conversation to Irish reunification. So she's saying just the simple response this week, the likes of the Karen Bradley comments, the Gavin Williamson comments, that is all sort of feeding into this view. And again, we're being told frequently by the likes of the Taoiseach and Simon Coveney that we shouldn't really be mentioning the border poll issue. When they were running for Fine Gael leadership, both of them
had a lot to say on this issue. In fact, the Taoiseach was going to prepare a white paper on it. Now, I know events have preceded that.
Oh, they have,
but there is such a conversation to be had. We were speaking about it upstairs. The national anthem. Will our flag have to change? Will Stormont continue to exist? Like, all this has to be dealt with. But it's part of the conversation that has to happen. But the first thing that has to happen is the reparation element.
But you know, one of the
Sorry, come to you in a second. Yes,
John. Yeah, no, just I suppose going back to the Bloody Sunday, I mean, there may be a distinction between, in some sense, moral justice and legal requirements. And as I understand it, DPPs in general, and it's certainly the case in the Republic, I don't know if the feeling is the same in the North, but the sole and only criterion they have to make a decision whether to prosecute is that they believe, on the basis of the evidence and all the complications and that, there's a reasonable doubt that they will be convicted. They're not into the politics of the thing. Maybe they should be, but they're not. They're not into how people will or will not
they
react.
They do, because...
They have a narrow focus.
Right.
And they are typically quite independent. Certainly in Ireland, in here, they have been shown to be pretty independent in deciding to, sometimes controversially,
There's two tests for prosecution, and one is the evidential test, and the PPS have to be satisfied, and the other one is a public interest test. So that is political when you think about it. If something isn't in the public interest, why is it not in the public interest at that stage?
And but they take you don't change the rules.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to charge somebody with something as mega as murder, you can't just change the rules for political reasons.
It's very strange, because the reason why we thought there would be more people charged is because all of those soldiers made admissions to the Royal Military Police in 1972, thinking that those admissions would never see the light of day. The PPS has ruled that they're inadmissible, because if you're in the army, and you know this better, you have to make a statement. You're not saying, would you like to make a statement? You know, they come along and say, right, make a statement now. So he said that they were forcibly, they could argue that they didn't.
Just as a general principle, if somebody's going to be charged with murder, it would tear the faith and the standing out of any justice at all if you were going to change the rules for political reasons.
But in this case, you're not talking... The men are... Well, in this case, it's one man now who seems to be going to be... up before the judge. But how did these people end up there? There's a broader context to it, and the inquiries never fully got to grips with that, and we're not talking about
I don't want to rehash Savile or anything.
Not rehashing it, but in terms of the broader context. And that's why I think just to try and understand it maybe from British eyes, from a point of view, why they see this guy maybe being a potential scapegoat or others like him. There were orders given, people were deployed, there were mistakes made. This is acknowledged now. At a time when public order training for troops was very infantile and mistakes were made. I mean, it turned out to have tragic consequences in Bloody Sunday. There were shambolic consequences on our side of the border that we never really heard or discussed. The training was based in colonial concepts of keeping the natives. Like, there was an Irish military riot platoon sent to Mountjoy in the 70s and to deal with an outbreak of violence that the prison staff and the Gardaí couldn't contain, and they had brought with them their whole paraphernalia, which included a banner saying "Disperse or we fire," to give full clarity. Except it was written in Cypriot and Turkish. And I'm saying it's from Little
Mary. Let me go to Bobby now.
I think, Mary, one of the sad things is the change in tone from David Cameron's statement after the Savile report and the statement by Gavin Williamson, the Secretary of State for Defence. I think it's part of the debasing of British public debate post-Brexit and the Tory party's lurch to the right. I mean, we all agree that it is a difficult and painful time for the family, as Tony was saying on your programme yesterday and Alison was saying now. And the Secretary of State for Defence made no reference to the families in his statement. It was so much at variance with what David Cameron said. And I think we do need to give just a little bit of credit. It doesn't mean that the families are satisfied or should be satisfied, but it was the British state that set up the Savile inquiry. It was their Prime Minister who made a statement in the House of Commons, and they are prosecuting one of the soldiers. Now, you might say they should prosecute more, but there aren't very many countries in the world that would have gone through that sort of process. Now, I would find it difficult to second-guess the public prosecution service in Northern Ireland. I haven't read the evidence, but what concerns me is that the Secretary of State for Defence, in his way, seems to be second-guessing it by implying that this prosecution shouldn't be bought, shouldn't be brought. Mm-hmm. And I agree very much with Alison that there's need for comprehensive legislation to deal with legacy issues, to implement the Stormont House Agreement. It's been sitting there since the autumn. And I agree also with what Tony yesterday and people today have said, that all families who lost loved ones must have access to effective
because there's a perception of injustice. There's a perception that some families are getting some and some aren't.
I know.
And
yeah.
So it needs to be a mechanism that gives
though
everyone equal
access
to it.
That statement that justice for one is justice for all, that really seemed to calm down the situation, that everybody could get a piece of that justice as part of the group.
I just think that, you know, we're such a long way off anyone being convicted. Right. And I think that when it comes to that time, are they going to be disappointed again? And I think it's cruel and it's unfair. And we're talking about Gavin Williamson's words. We can use our words to heal. And in the past, if we look at the politicians who were in charge around the Good Friday Agreement, they used their words to heal. And now we have people who are using them to hurt. And I think that that's very...
Okay, I want to move on to Christchurch. And you picked out, Niamh, the Sindo page, the Christchurch killer product, An Internet Age, More Will Follow.
Yeah, he was Googling Anders Breivik and had written his name on one of the weapons. And that's an interesting comparison because we were speaking about this upstairs, that this that initial attack shocked Norway. They didn't think that something like that could happen in their country. They wouldn't have matched their global view as a country with white supremacy. And certainly in New Zealand, you know, the deep irony of a white person going down there and claiming to be of the land or whatever. But apart from that, you know, the idea that the terror threat level was very similar to ours, possible but not likely. So they were possibly looking for, say, a jihadist threat, same as we are.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any talk in this country about the type of white supremacy attack that we've seen. That's interesting. Because
well, it'd be interesting to know, which is very difficult to know, is there Islamophobia here?
Well, my colleague in the Sunday Independent, Philip Ryan, has written a lot about this. The idea that perhaps, you know, do we know what is being preached in the mosques? And obviously there's so many different languages within Islam, so many different countries of people coming together. But that's all very basic. I mean, there's an article in the paper today that hazards a guess is about 100 people in this country that may or may not be sort of open to that type of talk. And I think it's interesting, bar the one woman that we know of who was a former member of the Defence Forces, a lot of the people who've been radicalised here and who've left here have been foreigners, and you wonder whether they would have been, you know, turned towards ISIS in whatever country they may have been living in.
Yeah.
But I suppose the more interesting thing is how the fact that his face has been pixelated on television and in the media is it reminds me of how Breivik was treated. There's a very good RTE doc on One about the rights that he was entitled to in custody.
I remember him objecting to the fact that he was getting fast food and that he needed...
He wanted better grub.
He wanted better grub.
There was a lot of pandering to him. Can we come back to a point you made
Just very briefly,
You said your question was there Islamophobia in Ireland. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I don't think there's much evidence of Islamophobia in New Zealand, for example, and this is what has happened. And that's the point to take out.
Yeah.
That there is a weak point, there is a chink in Western society's armour for this particular reactive to Islamic extremism. This is for every action, there's a reaction. And that these individuals who once upon a time we would have laughed them off as tinfoil hat wearers, but because of the internet allowing them coalesce and enable each other and push each other beyond the bounds, further beyond the bounds of extremism, all you need are these, to use another phrase, lone wolf individuals who have the will. They don't even need access to firearms.
And that these attacks mimic each other, bizarrely. This attack reminded me of the Bataclan, which is obviously done for a committee. It reminded me of Charlie Hebdo. And at that time, there was a huge conversation about, you know, should we be shutting down talk? Should we be shutting down freedom of speech? Because it had just gone a little bit, a touch too far, even from a parody perspective. But in this instance, how do you control the internet? I mean, the Taoiseach in the Sunday Independent is saying that there should be zero tolerance on terror posts. The idea that they haven't gotten to grips with taking down footage of this.
Well, there is an incentive, just to be aware of this. Our own Dr. Maura Conway from DCU has led an EU-funded initiative that has been very successful in shutting down access to the internet, to tweeting platforms of extremist jihadi sites for some time.
Okay.
But we have to remember, it's not purely about the internet. It's within communities identifying seeds of extremism. When people start to exhibit this, what do we do? We have no plan for that at the moment.
Okay. You're just back from the United States, Donald. Do you get a sense in the United States, because certainly Trump appears to be an Islamophobe and trying to block people, it's such a mixed society. You're based in Washington,
yes,
aren't you?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of colours and creeds and, mm-hmm, and all of that. Is there a sense of Islamophobia there?
Among certain people, there is. I think the, you know, this country was basically white and was founded by white people, etc., etc.
Yeah, it's ours.
And we see over the decades, more visibly maybe now, although the number of immigrants has not actually risen, we see this somehow our intrinsic American culture being challenged. This, of course, goes against the melting pot idea, but the melting pot, probably for much of the period, really covered white people, including, of course, Eastern Europe and all of that. But white people are not necessarily Iranians
or
brown people,
yeah,
or whatever. Hispanics is sort of a little bit on the margin. Yes, I think it's there. And, you know, there was a poll last week that said 90% of Republican Party or strongly support, Republican Party members strongly support Mr. Trump and his views on these matters.
Right.
I was in New Zealand in January on holiday, and it's such a fantastic, beautiful, civilized country. The people are so decent and friendly and relaxed. Mm-hmm. So it makes this all the more shocking. And one of the tiny rays of light over the last few days is the wonderful response of the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, and the announcement within 24 hours of the attack that they're going to change their gun laws. I think there are other people who could take,
right,
who take a lesson from that. And also, I think it's really important that people stop making comments that are negative about Muslims. I mean, Boris Johnson, for example, tweeted, "All our thoughts and our prayers are with the people of New Zealand." And somebody else responded, "Well, you shouldn't describe Muslim women as postboxes and bank robbers." Because these things,
right,
start with basic prejudice.
Okay, I'm going to go to a break, but I have interesting news from New York, St. Patrick's Day Parade. The Sinn Féin leader has been condemned for marching behind what is called an offensive banner in New York, St. Patrick's Day Parade. Mary Lou McDonald helped carry a sign which read, "England, get out of Ireland," and she took part in the city's annual parade to mark the Irish National Day on Saturday. Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister, Simon Coveney, accused Ms. McDonald of poor leadership and of being an embarrassment over her actions. He tweeted, "Mary Lou McDonald, this is not leadership. It's offensive, divisive and an embarrassment. Grow up. This is not hashtag Ireland in 2019. We're better than this." He made the remarks after Sinn Féin posted a photograph of their party leader at the parade. God, there's always a row about the parade in New York. And Ms. McDonald was in the United States to take part in that, in the annual festivities.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And thank you very, very much indeed for that. And the St. Patrick's Day Parade is just kicking off in Dublin City Centre and I presume elsewhere around the country. And Conor Pope of the Irish Times is there. Conor, where are you at the moment and what is the atmosphere like where you are?
Right now, Marion, I'm standing under the shadow of the GPO and the parade is just about to get underway. We're actually waiting for the President to arrive now. And I have to say, I think there's a huge amount of collective relief because the weather gods smiled on St. Patrick.
Good.
And have smiled on Ireland this year because there's a gorgeous blue sky overhead, the sun is shining, and it's not that cold. Now, you have to remember that earlier in the week, Met Aaron were predicting that there would be snow on St. Patrick's Day, and I think if it had there been snow, that would have been miserable for the hundreds of thousands of people who have lined the parade route, particularly the people who have lined the parade route from about 7 o'clock this morning, because there are people who want to get the best vantage point, and to get that best vantage point, which is just outside the GPO, you have to be here very, very early.
Well, yeah, that's a big commitment to be there at 7:30 in the morning. What is the theme for this year's parade?
The theme this year is Shamakies and Storytelling. Now, that's sufficiently loose, I think, that it could mean almost anything.
Yeah.
But having said that, it'll still be a bit of crack and there'll be the big parade regulars like the Spree people and the Gaucha people in Cork. And, you know, they've all pulled out all the stops. And I'm told by the organisers that they have something pretty special lined up. Now, as I say, it hasn't started yet. It's going to start, I think, it was due to start at midday, but like everything in Ireland, it's probably running a few minutes late. So it'll be about 10 or 15 minutes, I think, before it starts.
You were at the breakfast this morning.
I was. Now, that's where, you know, every year the St. Patrick's Festival organises breakfast, and that's where the Grand Marshals give a, you know, say a few words, and the organisers say a few words. And this year, for the first time, I think, ever, it was held in the pillar room in the Rotunda Hospital. That's, as I say, the Grand Marshals, and it's actually two Grand Marshals this year. There's Deirdre O'Kane and Jason Byrne, and they were introduced to the gathering at an event that was sponsored by Tesco, which meant there was lots of breakfast food there on offer, which is kind of a nice way to start the day rather than standing in the freezing cold. All of the people who were there just took a short walk from the rotunda down to the grandstands, where the viewing is getting underway.
And tell me, who'll be there on the grandstand? Obviously, you're waiting for the president.
Yeah, so there's the president. There's an awful lot of invited guests from the festival organisers. There's a couple of familiar faces. I think I saw Ray Darcy walking down the street there with his young son. And then there's all sorts of people from across the world. Because, I mean, I think the Fáilte Ireland people, and I was talking to Paul Kelly, the chief executive of Fáilte Ireland, and this is a really, really big deal for them. I mean, they put an awful lot of money into the festival because it gets them a huge amount of attention globally. And it's where they really kickstart the marketing season or the tourism season for Ireland. There's an awful lot of people outside of Ireland would be considering making their holiday bookings now. So what the St. Patrick's Festival does, and I think they do deserve a huge amount of credit because they've turned it into a massive thing. Yeah. Like when I was a child, and I'm sure it was the same when you were young, Marion, St. Patrick's Day is a pretty miserable affair. You'd see a few Matthew Ferguson tractors trundling up and down Shop Street in Galway, and they'd be throwing sweets out at the kids, and that would be the end of it. Whereas now it's a four-day affair, and it's a big, big event.
Yeah, I was just talking about it before we went to you. I just associated with freezing cold, lashing rain, then not being able to get home because there are no buses, and all in all, not joyous. But I mean, they transformed it now into an amazing production.
And it's worth acknowledging the fact that St. Patrick's Day and the St. Patrick's Festival is one of the big world festivals. I mean, I think sometimes in Ireland we can take these things for granted. And when it comes to cynicism and begrudgery, we're never found wanting. But when you think about it, St. Patrick's Day is one of only three national holidays across the world that I think most people could identify. Everyone probably can identify July the 4th, Bastille Day in France, and St. Patrick's Day. I mean, if you were to ask people in any part of the world when, you know, when St. David's Day is, George's Day or St. Andrew's Day, or when it's a national holiday in Spain or Italy or Germany, nobody would have a grieve. Whereas everybody recognises St. Patrick's Day. And I think that's a really good way to leverage tourism and visitors to this country.
Yeah, it is indeed. Listen, Conor, the phone line is just beginning to deteriorate a tiny bit. So we will leave it there and enjoy. And I hope the weather holds.
Fingers crossed. Thank you.
All the best. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Now, we just heard from Conor Pope about the events in Dublin for this St. Patrick's weekend. But serious business is also afoot around the world, which I sometimes think gets lost in the publicity. But anyway, every EU capital will have an Irish government minister attending celebrations. As we know, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, visited Washington, D.C. and indeed Chicago, meeting with President Donald Trump and his Vice President Mike Pence. It's not just the politicians, though, that are working there. Julie Cinnamon is the CEO of Enterprise Ireland, and she joins me pretty well fresh off the plane. In the space of 7 days, Julie, you were in Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., a whirlwind, and really raising the point about Irish investment in the United States. Can you fill us in on that?
Thanks, Marion. Yeah, we were there. We had 50 events over the course of the week. We had over 100 companies in the US with us. And a big part of the messaging this week was to raise the profile of the investment in the US by Irish companies. There's a lot of discussion about exporting jobs from America. There's 155,000 people employed in Ireland by US multinationals.
Yes.
But there's 100,000 people employed in the US by Irish companies. And so we were there putting a big profile on the expansion and the impact of Irish investment in the US.
And how do you get that across?
Well, we were at a lot of meetings. We had dinners. We had lunches where we had a global Irish lunch. And that would have been with IDA Ireland, bringing target companies to the launch, Tourism Ireland and Enterprise Ireland, all working together and putting a profile on Ireland's contribution to the US. We would have had meetings with opinion leaders. We would have done media interviews to get it across in terms of the two-way street, so that people realise we have over 500 Enterprise Ireland clients with a presence in the US.
Why do you think it's important that that be known widely within the United States?
Well, there has been a lot of negativity about the impact of jobs in other countries taking away from the US. And it's a surprise to most people that there's 100,000. It's quite balanced given the size of Ireland relative to the US that we're contributing so much. And we had great young companies, you know, for example, Netwatch in Carlow, and they have 250 people employed in the US doing running security systems. So you may have car dealerships or marijuana plants, all sorts of things. And it is being secured with 200 people in Carlow who have a high technology technology watching the facilities in the US. So that's, you know, just using technology to do something that otherwise would
and
have been done.
And why do they invest in the US? Why don't they invest here? I sound like
Trump.
Well,
they do,
now,
they do invest and they have a significant presence in Ireland. But the people in the States are really, they've taken over companies in the US to get into the market at a faster rate. So it isn't an either or, it's developing, and we've companies like Glumbia and Kerry that developed in the US and have subsequently brought that technology back to Ireland and are supplying world markets from Ireland.
Right.
So it's a win-win in terms of recognising
right.
that if you want to do business in the US as well, you can't just fly in, have a meeting, do a transaction. What we're all about is developing a relationship and putting a presence in the ground. And 60 of our companies in 2018 would have put a presence into the US market. And that presence goes from a sales office to a full manufacturing facility and everything in between.
Right. What was the White House like on the day?
The White House on the day was very enjoyable. It's a pretty special day to go into the White House and you have full access to the ground floor of it. And the fact that it is full of Irish people and there is an Irish party in full swing. So that's at the very enjoyable day out. There's obviously an economic piece to it. There's a political aspect to it. And there's a social aspect as to will Melania turn up and what will her dress be like.
And what was it like?
Her dress was beautiful and she's absolutely stunning. Looking and her shoes were a talking point for half the night. The height of them, we don't actually understand how she can stand in them, not to mention walk in them.
Right.
So it was.
She walked down the avenue after the inauguration. I couldn't take my eyes off her shoes. Never a wobble, and she had stoppers on. That
well,
height.
she had stilettos, which certainly would have added about 10 inches to her height. And
it's not as though she's a teeny tiny.
No, she's.
You were at one of. I was at one of them too, but I couldn't go this year, sadly. But they're special. On the other hand, you kind of feel like a groupie.
Kind of. Well, when you're in there, it's interesting the difference between the Obama White House that I've noticed and the Trump White House. I mean, there was a certain element with Obama that the Irish team, when they got over there, kind of hit the ground running. There was already a relationship, or people were already maybe more open to a relationship, if that's fair, Julie. And I think it's interesting as well, Theresa May would learn a lot about how we've managed to cultivate our relationships. I mean, I think it was mentioned earlier, we just have a calling card all across the world on St. Paddy's Day.
It is unbelievable,
and
really.
That,
I was watching it on some station last night. And, I mean, countries that you would think wouldn't even
yeah.
know where we were.
That the greening is taking place and
yeah.
whatever. And the fact that year on year, our ministers are going out there. You can look at it cynically and drum up the cost of the flights and the accommodation, or you can say, you know, this is actually probably going to be beneficial to us. But say, in any of the trade missions I've been on to the Far East, which is where Theresa May will be looking for a deal, very difficult to cultivate relationships out there. It takes a long time for Irish businesses. They sign a lot of memorandums of understanding. There's a lot of tea ceremonies that take place in order to do deals. Whereas then you had the spectre of the Taoiseach. And it's funny, actually, when you go into the Oval Office,
when the media go in anyway, it used to just be a photo call. So you would stand there for 2 seconds. And you see, the problem is that the Taoiseach and the President haven't yet spoken. So you're getting the photo ahead of their talks. But the last 2 years, this has turned into a press conference. And the Taoiseach saying to Donald Trump, kind of using this opportunity to say, you know, we should really do a deal between the US and the EU. And Trump really started going in, kind of his big size 11s as usual, saying that the EU hasn't been very kind to him. And, you know, he's keen and ready to do a deal with Britain. And the Taoiseach kind of saying, well, you know, we disagree on that, but let's talk about that in a few minutes' time. It's a very interesting dynamic.
Somebody was writing in one of the articles that was chosen this morning about the idea of Ireland sidling into the position that Britain had as a bridge between the US and
the EU. That special relationship to me seems to be fading quite quickly between... Now, it's funny because with Britain, like, let's be honest about it. The Taoiseach and the Taoiseach both in recent weeks have said they don't think that the Americans will do a trade deal if the Irish border is undermined in this country and the Good Friday Agreement is undermined. You know, Trump will do a deal with whoever he wants to do a deal with, let's be honest about it. Exactly. Now, there are Irish people on the Ways and Means Committee who have oversight of any trade deals that would certainly have our ear. But when it comes down to it, now, how long do trade deals take? I'm sure Julie could tell us all about that.
How long do they take? Decades. I'll come to you in a second, Donna.
Well, trade deals take years to negotiate at country level, and then the trade beyond that between companies. I mean, once you arrive in a country, you can assume it's going to take 24 months before you actually get at company level, but you can, you know, can take 5 or 7 years for a trade deal to be done between nations. So
right.
These aren't...
Well, just to comment on this question of the trade deal between the US and the EU, or Britain outside the EU, say, post-Brexit, I think there's been a fair bit of confusion about this, because we've heard a lot in the last few weeks about American political leaders saying, we will not agree to a trade deal with Britain unless there's no hard border. The problem is that the only way that Britain outside the EU could negotiate a trade deal is if there is no, if they are not in a customs union. By definition, if you're in a customs union, you cannot have separate deals with Britain. You know, with
but
the US.
They don't want a customs.
Well, but the point is, the logic is that if there is a customs union, and that's the only way that America would ever be able to negotiate a deal with the EU, then. With Britain, then you have to have a hard border. I mean, you're outside the customs union. Britain is outside the customs union. It's going to be a hard border. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain illogicality in the American position of saying we will negotiate a deal provided you don't have a hard border. That doesn't add up.
I think, Marion, that trade deals are about being intelligent, not about being nice. And they're very tough negotiations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when Trump says he'll do an easy deal with the British, and apart from the point Donald was making, we know the Americans will push very hard to get the chlorinated chicken into the UK and all
course,
sorts of things.
Yeah.
I just like to make one point, you know, following on what Julie was saying and the wonderful visit to the White House, and that is that, you know, we have a huge impact all around the world. Now, when the idea comes back of Trump visiting Ireland over the next year, we just have to remember that it's not really plausible to get all of the benefits, the impact of visiting Washington, which is of immense benefit to our country, and then not to welcome in some way the President of the United States. We have to draw a distinction between the person and the country.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I would share a pretty widespread view that his populism and infantilization of public debate is a part of a wider phenomenon, including Brexit, which is distasteful and worrying. But we have an immensely close relationship with the United States. We've spoken about their role, not just on the Good Friday Agreement, but an Anglo-Irish relations going back before that, the pressure that they put on British governments. We have the trade and business relationship that Julia mentioned. We have investment in both directions, and at personal level, the friendships. So I think we have to look at it in terms of relations between the two countries.
Okay, let me come back to you, Julie, if I may. You were leading the US economic mission, but Enterprise Ireland had events on 4 continents.
That's right. We have, there's 37 ministers this week in 57 countries, and we have them right from Washington to Sydney and Singapore and right across Europe. And this is about using the St. Patrick's Week, which it has become, to open those doors at a high level in different countries to let Irish companies come in behind them. So it has been fantastic just in terms...
Why would they not let Irish companies come in?
Well, it isn't that they wouldn't let them in, but effectively, if you're arriving into a country and you're inviting a target customer that you can't access, and you say, I have a minister from Ireland coming and we'd like to invite you for lunch, that is access that we take for granted in this country, but is really special, and it allows companies to access people that they wouldn't otherwise get. And then after the lunch, you have 2 hours effectively to sit and form a relationship, and then the business will follow. So right. It opens doors that are very difficult to open.
Well, funnily enough, I was in the White House on St. Patrick's Day on one occasion. I think it was when Noreen O'Sullivan was commissioner. And she was saying it was invaluable from her point of view because she had contacts way up the food chain, mm-hmm. senior in their police, that she would now have their telephone number, that she would call them and not have to go through the formalities. I mean, that's invaluable.
Being into all of these events and having business cards from these people and a relationship, and you can then reference whatever events you have met them at, and, you know, it really does form a relationship or give you the opportunity to form a relationship.
And there's only two times in a year that the American president goes up onto the Hill, and one of them is for that luncheon that happens with the speaker. Yeah. It was hosted obviously this year by Nancy Pelosi. So that idea in itself, that the sort of Irishness, now we're trying to use that to our advantage with the visas as well. We're trying to get these E3 visas and talking to Donald Trump, mm-hmm. I presume this time, although I don't know this for a fact, about undocumented Irish, possibly has fallen on deaf ears, and there were great efforts by John Deasy to resolve that situation recently, but you know, he's building a wall.
But Niamh, that's a very good point as you bring that up. That's a reminder to us that you can't take it for granted. I mean, the visas, you might have thought that would have been a done deal given this close relationship. And that brings us back to a point of real politique. You also mentioned something that I think is interesting too. The nature of the special, Ireland has a special relationship with the US and so does the UK, but they're based in different things. Mm. In Ireland, it's much more sentimental. Now, I don't mean, I'm not trivializing.
Family, really.
It's family. So you mentioned about Noreen going over.
Yeah.
And of course, John Brennan, wasn't it John Brennan who was director of the CIA, whose father was from the west of Ireland, who came here and drank pints in Doheny and Nesbitt's with senior members of the security services. Now, that's great. But at the same time, Britain is the country that will pony up if there's a major demarche that leads to military action. Who can we rely on? They can rely on the Brits. Mm. You know, and I'm not saying that we have to copy that, but what we have to have is something tangible. What can you bring to the table?
What would you say to that, Julie?
Often think about that.
Well, I think the number of Irish Americans and the number of votes associated with Irish Americans also helps. That would have been one of the points that the president made in the White House in terms of keeping that warm relationship. But I think the value of relationships at all those levels in every aspect of American society, there's deep relationships with Ireland, and we can use them to our advantage.
Post-Brexit, do you think it's feasible or do you think it's madness to think that we could end up as some kind of bridge between the US and the EU in a way that Britain used to be?
Well, we are the only English-speaking people that would be in the EU post-Brexit.
So who do you ring?
So, from an Irish perspective, we have a very... that will be important, and it came up a number of times in the last week. And obviously, IDA Ireland were there last week from attracting foreign companies into Ireland and selling the fact that we will be the only English-speaking country left in the EU. So that's something which is important. I think the political relationship with Ireland will become more important within the EU going forward as well.
I agree with Julie, but it's not just about English-speaking countries. That's just to call, keep it in perspective. As soon as Britain announced that it was leaving the European Union, Germany and France became the United States' most important interlocutors in Europe. I mean, of course we have a very close relationship. Of course we can and will use it, and it's reciprocated. But the realpolitik that Declan was talking about, you know, Britain has decided to opt away from influence in the world, and it still will be an important friend of America, but already Germany, I mean, I know Merkel and Trump don't get on particularly well, but in terms of fundamental interests, you know, Germany and France will be the major partners for the United States.
Just to say on the visa question that you mentioned, I mean, this is a little bit sobering, actually, because we've been trying for a long time now. We thought we had a deal.
The leftovers
from the Australians. Mm-hmm. But that has got stuck in Congress. And there are people, including, I don't know if you saw it during the week, a book by Trina Fargo published on Irish-American relations, which is, she's quite a controversial person in many ways.
I saw the write-up, but I didn't read the book.
Yes, the review was very good, but she has argued, and she's been very closely involved in many funds and, you know, scholarships and all that sort of thing, that actually the days when the Irish in the US could use their particular Irishness to get special deals on immigration and other things are not there anymore. I don't know whether you would quite agree. And she thought that it was a tactical mistake for the last couple of years for the Irish immigration reform movement to say, we want a special deal for Irish because we're special. As opposed to joining in a more general, you know, programme of amnesty along with others, Hispanics and so on, and then getting our piece of the action. Now, I don't know what you would think, which is the approach correct, but it's fairly interesting, I think.
It's certainly come up for discussion a lot in the last week, and I think it still is an opportunity for Ireland to get some sort of a deal.
But this it comes back to the groupthink, because in order sometimes to get the deal you want, you have to take actions that are maybe counterintuitive. Like, I think the point in some quarters in the US, they saw the Irish as being looking for a special deal and nearly being divisive and nearly being racist. Like, why wouldn't you pick us? And instead of going down the line of being maybe approaching it in a more cross ethnic approach, and then we wouldn't have created maybe some. Where is the resistance? Why is the resistance? Doesn't everybody love us? We need to get beyond that. We need to figure out what we do to continue that love affair, not to hark back to past
stories.
To come back to your own organisation, probably the IDA has a higher profile than Enterprise Ireland does. What's your spread in the world now?
We have 34 offices around the world, and we're opening 7 new offices this year post-Brexit, and those offices will go from Vietnam, an additional office in Australia, Europe, an additional office in the UK. We won't be walking. UK is our number one market and will continue to be so. So we've opened an office in Manchester, and one of the offices that will be announced next week is Seattle. Kieran Cannon, Minister Cannon, will be in Seattle, and we'll open an additional office in the US. So we've 34, and that will be 41 by the end of the year.
And in terms of people preparing for Brexit and your website, you've seen movement
on that. We've seen a big movement over the last 6 months, probably a tenfold level of interest from people going in. We've also seen a higher level, you know, the last survey we did, 85% of the companies had said they're working on Brexit plans, and we would see that in terms of the participation in trade missions, such as this week across the world. Companies work on their innovation and the competitiveness side, and just, you know, working on, you know, customs preparation and supply chains and currency management across all aspects of
the currency
Brexit.
Management. I see somebody writing about it today. I think you picked that one out, Donald, not to bet the house, so to speak, on currency fluctuations. Because, okay, it went down, but it's been steady since then, hasn't it?
You know, I completely agree that I think there's anyone who takes the predictions of people, some of whom are paid quite highly, to tell you whether the, you know, dollar or euro is going up or down, ignore them. And that's what I always say. I mean, I sort of been in this business for many decades, but whenever anybody asks me on a plane, do you think the dollar will go up or the euro will go down? I say, I have no clue in the next month. And anyone who tells you that they do, wrong.
Well, they say making money from investments in exchange rates is like trying to catch a falling knife.
Right.
Although our advice to companies would be, you're not in the trading, currency trading business, and you have to protect yourselves. Mm. And in some cases, that means matching your imports and your exports to try to even out the risk. In other cases, it just means covering forward your currency.
You can hedge.
And you have to hedge in order to make sure that there isn't a swing of 10% and there's their profit gone and they're into losses.
And how do you do that?
You go to the bank and you take hedging. There are facilities and banks to do it.
Right.
Pay a little bit, but it's not a huge amount.
Takes
but you're
the risk
safe
out
for
of
your
it.
Currency exchange rate, you know, for the next 6 months or a year
right.
or whatever.
Right, yeah. That's And what's your biggest fear about Brexit?
Well, obviously, if there was a hard Brexit, it has massive implications in terms of going into the UK. Tariffs under our biggest export into the UK being food. That seems to have diminished with the votes in the last number of days, but we will see. So it's really the additional cost and administration and delays into the UK, particularly for food, and that's forcing companies from Ireland, irrespective of whether it's a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit, needing to potentially double their capacity in the UK to hold food so that they make sure that they can get on
in
the shelves
storage
in time. So there's storage costs associated with that, there's all the customs costs, and that adds administration, and it's, you know, suggested it's 7 to 10%, which is a big impact on the profitability of companies going into the UK.
Right. I've just been reminded, before I let you go, but Arlene Foster, as well as anybody else, has invited Donald Trump.
She did. She said if she got spoken to the president, she would invite him to Northern Ireland. I'm not sure under what authority, because she is no longer the First Minister, and I don't know. It would be like me inviting Donald Trump to come to Northern Ireland.
Well,
for
he might like to take your invitation.
For all the standing it would have. I don't know. I think that Arlene has, you know, illusions of grandeur, because she hasn't the authority to organise state visits, I don't think, in her current position.
Okay, now, with all the work you've done, have you got to follow up on all those meetings now?
Yeah, otherwise it's all wasted effort. I mean, what we've done this week is made a lot of introductions, and it's a matter of following up afterwards when those introductions and relationships are warm, to make sure that the business is done.
Right. Do ambassadors get involved in this sort of thing as well?
Oh, absolutely, they do. It's a priority for our embassies and our ambassadors and our trade division at home, and we work very closely with Enterprise Ireland and the other agencies. And one of the great things is that it is a team effort. In some places, Enterprise Ireland is co-located with the embassy. In other places, they're in the same city. And in many places, we have embassies, but we don't have Enterprise Ireland. So we absolutely work as a team, which is one of our great strengths as a country.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very, very much. Have a good sleep tonight.
Thank you very much, I will. Thank you. Okay.
I think you'll be entitled to it, and we'll take a break.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Sometimes, yes. Now, welcome back to the programme. If you remember, and it isn't that long ago, that you had to pull over and ask for directions on a family holiday, well, I would still willingly do that, or find out the football scores in a printed newspaper, or go to a travel agent. The chances are you're talking about a time before we had the World Wide Web. And this week, the system invented by the British physicist Tim Berners-Lee as a reflection of humanity, the good, the bad and the ugly, turns 30. And I'm joined in studio now by Carlin Lillington, technology journalist from the Irish Times, to talk really about how it's shaped our lives in that period of time. And you say the very thing that makes the web fantastic is the same thing that exposes the worst of society.
Yes, because what it does is it connects us in these incredible ways. It makes it sort of just not just from local communities out to the entire world. We can go almost anywhere on the web. We can view things, good or bad, on the web. We use it in our everyday life. It's now become such a norm that we no longer even think of it as something particularly special. It's just there.
Yeah, but it's wonderful to have.
And it's like a utility. Yeah. Yes, it's absolutely.
Now, somebody pointed out to me a while ago that they didn't invent traffic lights until they invented cars. So we have invented a wonderful phenomenon, but we haven't figured out quite how to handle it.
No, and that has become one of the major challenges now. And as a matter of fact, that has been raised numerous times by Tim Berners-Lee himself in interviews leading up to this 30th anniversary.
Yeah, he sounds very depressed about it all. And you'd imagine he'd be dancing.
He does. In one interview, he referred us, we're at this point where the web's turned into a downward plunge to a dysfunctional future, which isn't exactly the most cheerful thing to think of as we use our Google Maps, you know, but it's... this is probably the biggest issue, I would think, you know, that we have to deal with right now. I mean,
if you take how it evolved, you know, there was vague word about emails, and then people, they got emails. And then there was buying online. Just go through all of the things that came from it.
Oh my God! Well, that's a large volume of things.
Yes.
But let's touch. I mean, maybe a good place to start is just to talk a bit about community and what it enabled in our everyday lives now that we think of as being normal. I mean, it's probably worth making the point that the web is not the same as the internet. The internet existed before the World Wide Web, but those of us who are old enough, and probably some of us sitting here are, to have used it back before it was the web was there, you had to go in and type in you had to type in commands onto a computer screen, and all you saw was what they called the command line, sort of a blinking cursor and words. And what Tim Berners-Lee did was develop this thing that sat on top of it but made it visual to us, so we could click on links rather than having to type in a command saying, I'd like to go to a university archive at the University of Maryland and search to see what files they might have, if any of them might relate to, say, what I'm researching it for my university degree or whatever, yeah, because it was very limited to businesses, research, government agencies. So suddenly you had this way of very easily accessing information and moving about across this web, which came to be called surfing, of course. And so now you had these connections. So very quickly, businesses realized this was something that could be exploited. So did individuals, and so did governments. Exploited in a positive way as well. So if you think in terms of community, I would think of just the small things that we take that are so central to our lives now. Being able to Skype a family member who's immigrated, for example, to see a grandchild at a distance for the first time, to online dating, for example. I mean, my mother is in her 80s, and she has a group of friends that they refer to themselves as the widows group. And apparently, when they meet every month for dinner, and all of them, I think, have now used Match.com, the dating site, to meet gentlemen of a certain age. And so, you know, we tend to think of this. And yes, my mother even confessed this to me. I must say, I was quite taken aback to discover my mother had gone to meet some man for coffee. But you know, that this is, it isn't just younger people, it's older people. We've reached the point where it's now the norm to go to a party, meet a new couple and say, oh, when, how did you meet? And they say, oh, through online dating, although people still seem a bit embarrassed to say something like that. Yeah. But we think of online ordering our groceries. You know, what a boon for, say, people who, if you're older and you don't have the mobility to get into Tesco or Super Value, Lidl is going to be introducing online shopping as well. Amazon.
I've only ever done it at Christmas time, and it's like magic. It's unbelievable that all your groceries arrive as if Santa had come early, you know. Why I don't do it all the year, I don't know, but it is pretty wonderful.
Mine was just alcohol when it came, and they wouldn't give it because the person who answered the door was too young, and they refused to give them the shopping. It shows you what I was ordering online. Yeah.
The cigars and the alcohol arrived, and the 10-year-old couldn't accept
it. I was wondering what, Karen, you know, what your thoughts are on this whole question of the traffic lights and what traffic lights we could have, and particularly in terms of putting up firewalls or, you know, regulations to take down sites. For example, we used to live in Singapore for some years, and Singapore is a very socially conservative place, so they didn't like, you know, people putting inappropriate material through the internet, whatever that might be, you know, anti-gay rights and, you know, all that sort of thing. On the other hand, they're the technologically one of the most sophisticated countries in the world, and the communications were essential for Singapore to be so successful economically, which it has been financially. Anyway, they took a decision one day, having tried to marry both of these together, technological sophistication and censorship, they said, sorry, we can't do it anymore. We're going to abandon efforts to control access to the internet. And that was a Singapore decision. China, on the other hand, has, I think, but your view on this would be very interesting. Mm. They have maintained, apparently with some success, significant controls over access to sites from abroad that they don't like politically, socially, or whatever.
Yeah.
Some people say that it's only a matter of time before they have to end up like Singapore and say, we cannot keep doing this. And I understand in China there are hundreds of thousands of people who watch sites all the time and strike them out or control them or whatever. Is this a sustainable model? I'm not saying it's a good one, but is it sustainable?
It's a worrying one too, isn't it?
You know, it is completely, and it actually, and I think in a place like China is probably the biggest surveillance state of its own people, utilizing the internet to watch people, where even what their equivalent of like Facebook is now used to create a social score for you.
Yes.
Depending on how good a citizen you are. And there are people who, I know there was a journalist who speaks Chinese who was traveling on a train, a U.S. journalist in China, and heard an announcement made saying basically if you were antisocial on the train, this was going to affect your social score. So it's really, it's quite Orwellian and of concern. But, you know, I think it's also important to note, if we're talking a bit about the ugly side of the web, that we too are under this kind of surveillance all the time, whether we notice it or not, not to the extent of China, not to the extent of where it's state controlled, but even companies know what we do down. This is why the Chinese government went to an equivalent of Facebook, because these companies know every single tiny thing we do.
Yeah.
Caroline, isn't it one of the things that I thought was quite disturbing? Not that the Chinese were able to do this with the connivance of leading tech companies. In other words, there were Western tech companies, in order to get access to the Chinese market,
compromised their principles.
Indeed. So what we have, and it leads in with exactly what you're saying. So the Chinese might be the state that is the most ability in surveillance, or that is the most activity in it. But we're seeing the state, whatever shape or form, being usurped by commercial entities, the big giants, the Facebooks, the Twitters, whatever else, in terms of surveillance of mass population for commercial purposes. But what happens when you get a totalitarian state and the connivance of commercial entities?
Well, what about the non-totalitarian state? I mean, our countries. Is there support? Should there be serious thought given to some, you know, regulator, whoever they come, wherever they are, come from, who would actually close down sites?
Well, that, as I said, that has happened.
You know,
I
mean,
you're probably familiar with Dr. Maura Conway's
censorship or not.
Yeah, it's very
funny. Well, it's appropriate in the sense that we don't allow posters up, you know, in public spaces that produce hate speech. So I think it is appropriate, and you can, the EU created guidelines. But the thing is, there will always be chinks in the armour, because it takes the sociology a while to catch up with the technology. And that brings us back to the New Zealand shootings, where you have, we'll say, white supremacists or whatever minority groups manufacturing their footprint. Their operational footprint. They don't have to have huge numbers. Like the guy in New Zealand or Anders Breivik, they don't represent a huge mindset. But because they're enabling each other, they're using the net, they have an
mutual
impact.
Support.
And they have an impact way beyond numbers. And we're not thinking about that. So the EU funded this project, and that dealt with one element of extremism. But there are all these other little pinpricks of it as well. And they won't be solved purely by looking at the internet as the regulating the internet.
It's a fine line, isn't it? Because
it is, people.
I think, were utterly revolted by the notion of putting mass killing up in that fashion. Who judges where is the line? Do you have views, Alison?
Well, I think social media changed a lot of things in relation to the internet. You know, and you said the World Wide Web, it was designed to give us information and connect us. Social media came afterwards, and we know that it can be a very toxic and very misogynist place. I have been subject to a lot of abuse on social media and on Twitter from men and anonymous accounts and faceless accounts. And I think that there is an argument for making the service providers have to abide by the same rules as any other publisher. So I'm a journalist, and if I libel somebody, I libel them in the paper and I'm responsible for that. Mm. Whereas Twitter and Facebook do not take responsibility for their users, and regardless of whether what they're saying is hate speech, whether it's encouraging violence, they have guidelines which they don't apply. And I know they don't apply because I've been subject to it myself. And there is an argument for regulating them in that way, and that they are responsible to remove it immediately, or else then they are the people who you sue for libel.
Carlin, what do you think?
It's a huge issue because, interestingly, again, this is an issue Tim Berners-Lee has raised. I mean, he is doing two different things trying to address this, because, I mean, he clearly feels quite responsible for this. One is he's pushing a project called Contract for the Web, which he launched at the last Web Summit in Lisbon. So there's a bit of an Irish connection there,
right,
because he spoke there. And he's pushing this idea that we need to start a dialogue between, he would say, three parties to this contract. It would be government, citizens, and businesses, for exactly these kinds of issues and how information is, how it's gathered, how it's used, these vast database storehouses of data, you know, of information on all of us that can be hacked, that
Cambridge
might be
Analytica
used in different ways.
Yeah.
The invisibility.
Absolutely.
He actually talks about Cambridge Analytica. Yeah, I mean, this clearly was a big turning point for him in that, and he cited Brexit and the election of Trump as here's examples of how you can have things that would have seemed quite out on the extreme edge suddenly being manipulated and in ways that we don't see. And I think this is what's really important.
It's the fact that we don't know.
We don't know that it's happening in the platforms like Facebook. And Google would feed advertising that they call dark advertising. Yeah. You and I might not see it because we haven't been marked as the kind of person who would be open to a particularly, you know, a particular right-wing message, or it could be left-wing message for that. Or
it hasn't been established.
So nobody can challenge it. It's not like it runs in the pages of the Irish Times or RTE airs an advertisement and someone can come back and say, that's not true. And what we saw in Brexit as well, in the advertising that was discussed in Parliament after an inquiry, was that many of the ads for Brexit weren't ever identified as ads.
Yes.
They were dark ads and they weren't identified as ads. And so people didn't even see that they were.
If I go back to the Trump election, what they did so successfully there was just speak to like-minded people.
Yeah.
So they didn't send Democrats stuff on Facebook. They sent it to people who wanted to hear.
And what's
but nobody knows that.
I think it is important because everybody starts to talk about Trump and how and Cambridge Analytica and the manipulation of the web. But many of these tools were developed by
the
Democrats.
Extremely successfully.
And Obama really laid down the example of what could be done with this information without, I think, a sense of how it could be exploited if you weren't doing something more visible, but something down below the ground that people didn't see. But they also were analyzing sentiment and the same sort of thing that we talk about, you know, depending on where you stand. So these issues are complex, and what you don't want to do is, who makes a decision on whose speech is okay? Yeah. Well, some things are clearer to us than others.
Sure. And it also happens at a very personal level.
Sorry,
as well.
Mark falls into that grey area.
You want to come in there, Donald, because I want to go on to the Arab Spring.
The moral issues, you know, about who decides and what they decide.
Yes.
I just wonder, is it actually technologically possible, I mean, given a reasonable expenditure of resources, to actually control and websites and knock them off or not? For example, even in China, I understand that actually most people in China, if they're smart at all, have found a way around the Chinese firewall. They just use, you know, more sophisticated techniques that the Chinese are able to stop. And there's certainly, I think, again, leaving aside the goodness or badness of the Trump-type activities, from what I've read, it would have been very difficult for, you know, regulators or people to have actually stopped this.
Yeah.
Because it's a mushroom cloud that goes all over the place.
Well, and it was poorly understood. I think this is the important. I remember when the Cambridge Analytica story first broke, and it was before the election had concluded, before we'd gone to, you know, as an American, I had my absentee vote, so I did my vote. And I was on a panel where in Trinity discussing law on the internet, and somebody on the panel handed me this printout of the story that her son had sent her in an email, and it referred to this Cambridge Analytica company. And I'd seen a bit of chatter about it, but it wasn't. First, there were big claims that they had manipulated the election, Brexit and Trump, and then there was a lot of doubt, and then suddenly it all began to come out with the Facebook
connection.
Can you
answer Donald's question? Can it be stopped?
No, not in the form. Well, yes, it depends on the resources you want to put into it, and not with the way companies are structured right now, for example. I mean, my argument has long been we seem to accept the way these companies operate with the way they gather information on us, and then the way in which they support themselves through the online advertising, which requires that targeting.
Yeah.
And then we hear the head of Facebook, for example, you know, Mark Zuckerberg saying, well, you're going to have to pay for it, as if that's the big threat, you know, if you don't allow us to do this.
Right.
Well, there's no reason why we have to allow the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons and everyone else in the world to do this kind of surveillance capitalism, as it's often called. So, but these are big decisions for society.
They are. How do you reflect back on the Arab Spring, because it was seen to be a key element within all of that and all the optimism that was there, and then it all dissipated.
But I think what the Arab Spring really showed was how you could have these grassroots campaigns which could sweep across a population and a whole region. And so it was a forerunner really to what we've seen with the further the Cambridge Analytica, the elections and things that maybe we don't like. But Arab Spring, that whole movement was so powerful, beginning in Tahrir Square in Egypt, where getting the information out was so important that I spoke to one of the activists who was in that square and who's a digital expert and trains other human rights activists in being careful when they're online and when they're so that they aren't exposed, and that they can teaches them to post things anonymously and to remain hit so that they can't be taken in by the authorities, for example. But he said the internet was so important, access to the web was so important in Tahrir Square, that they were tapping into the phone lines and the telephone, you know, the electricity poles to charge their phones and to upload this to film and then upload, so that the authorities could not deny that this movement was happening. And then that inspired so many others across the region.
But as a journalist, it's fascinating, because we do have a generation of my children's generation do not read newspapers, and they don't get their news from those sources. They get all their information comes from online, and the rise of fake news and the use of propaganda dressed up as news at times, I think, is very worrying. And we do have, and we've seen with the attacks in New Zealand, people who would never know each other, they would never contact each other, and now they do have a contact. So even though they might be quite small extremist groups, if you globally connect them through the internet, it becomes a much more powerful movement.
Which is the point Declan was making, there was such a surge of optimism around that time, and then it all went.
But you see, the Arab Spring it showed the potential to be able to provide a safe space for people to coalesce and express political opinions. That's what in countries that were totalitarian and riddled with secret police, the police states. But what it didn't allow for was the fact that there was a very reactionary, one-dimensional bunch of people that as soon as the boot was taken off the neck of that society, they emerged, they shoved the young educated Westerners who were in Tahrir Square and places like that trying to tell the world what was happening, and took the reins of a lot of those states. And I think the only state I can think of that benefited to some extent from the Arab Spring is Tunisia.
Which is where it started, kind of, there too, didn't it?
Well, they had a degree. There's a degree of bloodlessness compared to the
others. Except, of course, for the tragedy that happened on the beach, but that was a different thing.
But there were that was a reminder that nobody's safe from extremist attacks. And actually, that ties in with something we're talking about here. States, we mentioned about the US and Islamophobia and things like that. Yet the United States hasn't had anything of the nature of attacks on Islamic communities. But you've had states like Norway, very safe, kind of open society, New Zealand, UK. It's telling us that you can't control this.
I'm in the
this,
last minute, so just very quickly, do you figure that with pressure, those companies will have to address the issues we're talking about.
It's already an election issue in the US for the 2020 election. So and in
Elizabeth
the EU,
Warren
the EU
came out
as well is a big big star in this level.
Okay, now I'm going to have to leave it there. Lots of people talking about English in Malta and English in the Netherlands. Anyway, we'll leave that because we're out of time. And that's all from us for today. I'd like to thank everybody who contributed to the programme.